Live from a backyard in Arizona where it is hot and my cool glass of scotch is the only thing keeping me cool right now. It's Jaded Gamercast. I'm on vacation visiting family in Arizona. We were about to start the podcast. My mom and my wife and my brother came out to have a smoke, so we had to take a little break there. My mom's like, "What are you doing?" Like, oh, we're gonna do a podcast with my friend Nathan, talk about war games. And she's like, oh, and I'm like, and we cuss a lot during the podcast. You probably don't want to be here because she hates it. So I'm probably gonna have to keep the cussing to a minimum just so that she's not hearing like me dropping F bombs because it's just like a little door with like some windows. Like there's very little sound damping happening here. Paramount of professionalism. So if you guys hear crickets in the background, it's because I'm in the backyard. And, if Nathan breaks up a little bit during the podcast, it's because I'm in the backyard. So I'll apologize for that right off the bat, but let's get this started. Nathan, what are you drinking tonight, my friend?
Same thing as last week, delicious vodka and lime.
There you go, man. There you go. All right. So I'm just going to move my laptop here and just see if I can just get a slightly better signal if I just slide it away a little bit there. Well, and maybe if that extra 6 inches towards the door might give me an extra bar on the Wi-Fi. Oh, man. Okay, so yes, it is Jaded Gamercast. Let's kick right into Higher Learning here, because it is late. Let's get this podcast started. Higher Learning this week is Warriors of Chaos for Fantasy. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
All right, I'm going to get started into this one here. I've always had a little soft spot in my heart for Warriors of Chaos. And I think a lot of people share that love of the army because they have one of the coolest plastic kits, even though there's not a whole lot of variation to them. It's a lot of the same model over and over again. And in terms of elite armies in Warhammer, that is the one that's going to stand out as it's the Grey Knights of Warhammer. It is the army where you're going to have very, very few models on the table unless you're spamming Marauders and other stuff like that. But most people tend to not go with Marauders anymore. So usually when you see a Warriors of Chaos army, it is just Warriors of Chaos. You get a couple monsters in there. And, it's something that you see a lot at tournaments for that reason. A, it's very, very cool. B, you don't have to paint a ton of models. And it's also a very competitive army with a lot of options. I still miss the old days where the Chaos book for Warhammer included demons and beastmen. I felt like that made it a much more complete army. Now, I'm not saying that like the demon book is not good or the beastmen book is not good. They're obviously great books with a lot of cool like depth and stuff like that. But I feel like Warriors of Chaos, I don't know, they tend to seem a little bit flat now on their own. They just don't have as many options to kind of stand out, and especially really competitive options, because like the Shaggoth is in the Warriors of Chaos book instead of in the Beastman book for some weird reason, and
Yeah, that one makes no sense to me,
makes
but
no
yeah.
sense whatsoever. But
That
like,
and Dragon Ogres.
and yeah, exactly, right? But it's one of those things that it's in the book. And they've got stuff like, Chaos Trolls and Chaos Ogres and stuff like that, but they're not really great competitive units in the way that you really want them to. They typically tend to be overpriced or underpowered. And when you compare them to other stuff like, like a Corn Lord on a Juggernaut or a Demon Prince or a Greater Daemon, like you always tend to push those off to the side. So when you do see really competitive Warriors of Chaos armies, they tend to be just Warriors of Chaos with very, very few frills. And it's kind of disappointing to see that now. Like I went back and I put together a Warriors of Chaos list that was two big units as each, warriors with hand weapon and shield obviously, and like two 10-man units of Khorne warriors with halberds, to kind of to deal with like flanking and stuff like that. But even after doing that and putting like two hell cannons in the list, like I was already stacked for points. In a 2,500 point game, like it's a very tough army to try to fit everything that you need in there. I do want to talk about hell cannons before we get into anything specific. I'm going to say this right out the bat. You should take two hell cannons. I think anyone who bitches and complains about people who take two hell cannons are retarded. It's the only piece of shooting on the board for that army. It's the only thing on the
Hey,
board for that.
Marauder horsemen have
Oh,
thrown
go screw your.
weapons.
Listen, that's bullshit, okay? Because There's just nothing else there. So when you see someone taking two hell cannons, they're just trying to have some sort of shooting in their list, because one hell cannon just doesn't, it doesn't cut it. We all know that if you're going to take artillery like that, you take multiples, okay? And it's ridiculously expensive. I mean, we were saying about grudge throwers before, about them being way, way, way more expensive than a normal stone thrower. Like, yes, they're more dependable. Yes, they do more damage, but like, you're paying twice the points. Well, this thing is basically like taking a monster, you know, and a stone thrower in that same list. You take two of them, it's almost 500 points, right? Are they like 210 a piece or something like that? Like, that's,
I don't know. I don't play Warriors.
That's really, really expensive. So I think anyone who whines and complains about that is retarded. Like, that is not cheesy. It's not over the top. It's just an army taking advantage of their one shooting option that's worth a shit.
You know, I'm both, you know, in you know, I'm really on the fence about that, and really on the fence about the Hell Cannon, because you're absolutely right. The Hell Cannon is great, and if you're gonna find the points for two. With that being said, the Hell Cannon is despicable against low leadership armies. I mean, really, yeah. You know, it's forcing panic checks. You know, if you take a single casualty, panic checks on minuses. So I've literally seen an ogre army that was running a huge Death Star with the Tyrant run off the board because meeting engagement had it off. It walked on turn one, got hit by one Hell Cannon, panicked off the board, game over.
Okay, but that's... know?
That shouldn't happen. I get that. I'm not saying, you know, I'm not saying whatever.
It's an over-the-top situation when you're talking about, like, you got a BSB now, you got ogre, like, big names, you got all this other stuff that's going to help you to beef those units up. Like, yes, that can happen. It's a perk. It's a perk of the weapon. But again, you're paying so many points for it. And I've never gone up against one where it's run off the board. Like, I would say, like, 1 in 20 games, something like that might happen. So it's not like you can bank on that. As a chaos player.
But no, and that's the point, is I'm not saying that's broken or that it's dependable, but it's just like, you know, obviously that's best case scenario of you taking your Hell Cannon. But at the end of the day, you have point for point the single best core units in the entire game. So for me, I'm always of the opinion of why bother with the Hell Cannon when you can just make up for your lack of shooting with a good magic phase because you've got access to great lores, and just take more of your core warriors, you know, because your knights are the best in the game, your core is the best in the game, fuck, chosen are despicable, war shrines boosting your shit. So I mean, like, I can get two war shrines with marks for about the same price as a single Hell Cannon. So that's why I'm always just like, Hell Cannons are good, but I'm always on the fence because there's so many better options in that book. Yeah. But I mean, I don't know. Like I said, for me, Warriors of Chaos are just kind of bland now because the core is so good. Every single time I roll up against a Warriors of Chaos army, it's nothing but Warriors and one unit of Knights. And maybe, you know, and then, like, add in your fixings. Does he take a Hell Cannon, or does he take some Marauders, or does he take some Chosen? But that's really every last list. I think if I was going to give pointers on building Warriors of Chaos Army lists, I would straight up say don't go crazy on characters. Yep. You know, I really feel that Warriors,
you have to be a minimalist. You have to be a minimalist.
Hey, yeah, absolutely. I think your shit is so good that you should be sitting at two characters. One is your BSB, and then the other is either, you know, a Lord level wizard for the level 4. Because remember, he's still got the stat line of a General of the Empire, which is the Empire's fightiest of characters.
Well, so does like a Chosen, so does a Chosen Chaos Champion has the stat line, if not better, of an Empire General. Like, a lot of the kind of smaller heroes, they are going to get smashed in a challenge by like a normal chaos champion.
Yep.
You know, especially, I mean, if you give them some items or you make them chosen or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, absolutely. So like I said, for me, I would say take a BSB, take one other character. If you want to go super killy, take a Lord, put him on a chariot or a dragon if you're playing like 3,000 points or, you know, something. But like if you want super combat killy, take the Lord, gear him to the nines. Otherwise, take a Wizard Lord. Because he can wear armor. He's, what, the only wizard in all of Warhammer that can take armor? And when he starts...
No, vampires can.
Oh, you're right. Sorry there, too. But, I mean, you know, he's starting with 4-up Chaos Armor, so you can literally give him a 1-plus armor save without even breaking a sweat.
Yeah.
You know, you buy him a shield, give him a barded horse, 1-plus, done and done. You know, exactly. Mundane, you're not even using any of your magic points. So, I mean, you know, like I said, that's what I would do is you really have to be a minimalist when you play Warriors of Chaos, because
all of your shit is so expensive, so when you dump 500 points on your Killy Lord on a chariot or on a juggernaut or however it is, you have to always look at it and take that step back and just be like, you know what? Shit, this is like a block of Chosen I don't have for this one guy. And that's why, you know, you can't go crazy on characters, because every character you take is one or two units being removed from your army. And that's why you kind of hit that tipping point of your army is now too small to be effective.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you've got all these great characters, but when the unit they're in gets the tar beat out of them in combat, they're going to break and run with everyone else.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think another thing that I would recommend to people who are looking at getting into a Warriors of Chaos army is don't overlook the Demon Prince. I've said it 100 times. I think it's a gorgeous model. I absolutely love it. And I really, really do feel like when you talk about being a minimalist, you know, and you're saying, okay, we'll take a wizard and you know, give him armor, and he's still got like a good stat line, and he can still get in there and slug it out. What I kind of tend to look at is like, well, just make your Demon Prince a wizard, and have him be your lord. And I mean, like, he's got flight. You can build him relatively cheap. He's going to be able to get around the board. He's going to be able to stay out of, you know, problematic situations where he's going to get beat to crap. And you can give him a couple of extra perks where he can do more than just casting magic, you know, or causing terror on the flanks and stuff like that. But it also makes him a good, like, artillery hunter and things like that, because he can move so quickly. He does cost more points. Like, there's no way around that. But, you know, having a Demon Prince with a lot more wounds and a higher toughness and a good save, or like an extra ward, because I think if you do Demon Prince of Tzeentch and you make him a wizard, like, he has what, like a 3-up ward save or something, you know.
I think it's just a 4-up, but 4-up. No, you know what?
That's solid, man.
No, you're absolutely right, because at the end of the day, if you were to take your Demon Prince, give him some great demonic items, because there are really good ones in the Warriors book, and make him a level 4 wizard. He has access to lots of great lores. I mean, hell, even Lore of Tzeentch, if you give him Mark of Tzeentch to up his ward save. I mean, it's a fantastic lore, but I mean, he, you know, he does sort of become that jack of all trades, and points-wise, you're looking at only really spending 50 to 100 points more than a kitted-out Chaos Lord or wizard.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, like, it's not crazy. You know, Yeah, and I've run into a Warriors of Chaos army running the level 4 Demon Prince, and it's uncommon, you know, like, unlike every other, you know, Chaos Warrior, you know, Warriors of Chaos army, where you kind of get into that rinse and repeat mode, where you're just like, listen, your build is the same as the last Warriors of Chaos build I played, only you take a unit of Trolls instead of a unit of Chosen.
Right.
Whoopty shit. I still know the best. You know, I still have all the best tactics at beating you in combat.
Because,
I mean, really, you know, I have the winningest record against Warriors of Chaos Army simply because they are so rinse and repeat. I mean, I would like to say that I'm wholly undefeated, but fuck you, sweetie man, Mike. You ruined that streak.
Well, he did cheat by knocking all of your models off the table instead of actually beating you.
He throws them off the board in a rage. He cheats by playing over points. So, I mean, really, I mean, we should really just kind of count this as a draw and keep making absurd claims. But
well, you know, that's what you're good at. I think one of the things that people overlook in the Warriors of Chaos army, again, when you talk about being a minimalist, is taking 10-man units. You know, taking like a 10-man unit of Khorne warriors with halberds and just using them for flanks, using them for chewing up smaller units, having them as like throwaway units. You know, if you're trying to build your army for blood or glory, a 10-man unit of Khorne warriors is good for just tossing even an extra standard in. If you take 2 units of 10, Watchtower shows up. You merge those 2 units together, you toss them in the Watchtower. You know, like, it's a very, very, it's very, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, it's a very flexible unit. Like, you can do a lot with it, and it's relatively cheap, and you know exactly what you're going to do with it. Like, you're not expecting this unit to go and beat these units that cost twice as many points as they do, but, you know, like, it's easy to get them into flank if you're just running 5x2. Like, it's easy to get them into a flank. It's easy to get them into, like, additional frontages if you're going up against hordes. Like, it's just a very, very smart setup, because nobody's really going to put their attacks against that unit of Warriors of Khorne with halberds, because it's like, well, they're not reducing the ranks on the other unit that's in combat, you know, or if you're attacking a flank, that 4+ save is no big deal when he's only got 2 or 3 guys attacking back against your Khorne warriors, and you're putting out so many freaking attacks, it's ridiculous.
Well,
so I would say don't overlook that one.
No, definitely not. I think that's a great point.
Two best marks, though. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Finish what you were saying.
I was going to say in 8th edition, remember, initiative is king. And I mean, initiative 5 means you're striking before almost everything. I mean, fuck, even elf infantry is only initiative 4. So, I mean, unless it's high elves with always strike first, your 10 Khorne warriors with halberds get to strike first, throwing out, 15, 6, 21 attacks?
Something like that. Yeah, something like that.
They get to throw those out, and they're hitting. Yeah, they're hitting almost everything on 3s, and at strength 5, they're wounding most things on 2. So, I mean, it's just like, for very few points, you can throw out just a ton of hurt, and I think that just reinforces my point about they just have the best core in the game. So, I mean,
I would think that's debatable, but yeah.
You know, it's definitely debatable. I'm sure someone will probably come up and say that.
Somebody's going to come math hammer you out of that conversation.
Yeah, they'll just be like, well, you see, skinks with blowpipes are the best core because points for points. And if anyone does that on Facebook, they're banned. They're fucking banned.
Okay, so before we move on from this into our main topic here, what I want to talk about is chosen versus marks. I think that chosen tend to just cost too many points. As soon as you start upgrading chosen, like, it's just a lot of points to dump into units. I think that marks are always usually worth it, but like the two best marks when you're putting that army together is always going to be Khorne and Tzeentch. Like, those are the ones that in 8th edition are invaluable for the points that you pay. You know, getting frenzy, huge. You know, having the extra ward save, huge. Like, it just makes those units that much better, to the point where, like, if you look at a unit of Warriors of Chaos with a hand weapon and shield, they're more reliable than chosen. So, like, there's no real reason to upgrade stuff to chosen. I know a lot of people like to upgrade their knights to chosen, but
you can't do that anymore, dipshit.
Well, I don't play the fucking army. But hey, no, well, that answers that question.
Yeah.
All the more reason chosen, not to.
Well, I mean, chosen have their uses. I mean, if you're going to talk about the 5x2 unit of Warriors Khorne with halberds, you know, chosen will do it better. So, I mean, if you're ever just like, God, I got like 80 points left, upgrade them to chosen, because
chosen
is special. Yeah, that's the truth. You know, the chosen are special. Their weapon skill 6 and the ability to roll on Eye of the Gods means they're going to be better in some way, right? You know, mm-hmm. So I mean, that's always the thing that you have to look at. Chosen are a great unit. My biggest problem with them is, as you say, they are a lot of points, and where I have seen them excel is when you're also buffing with a couple war shrines, which is now adding 250 points onto the cost of that unit. So I mean, that's the big thing with chosen. I do know that there's people, you know, down in Cowtown that keep trying to math hammer out the odds of getting boxcars with Favor of the Gods for, you know, halberd Tzeentch warriors to have the 3 up ward save and be stubborn. But again, it's just so fucking many points. Like, that's the big problem with it. It's just like, sure, should you get the boxcar result on Eye of the Gods on one of your 3 rolls and Favor boosts it up or down by 1? The unit is indestructible. There's fuck all that is going to be able to kill it.
No, and that's usually the situation. It's just, you know, you're sacrificing another unit, or you're sacrificing another war shrine, or, you know, you're another character or a monster of some sort. And it's just, it's an army that anybody can play. It's very forgivable. But I think what you're going to find if you're going to get into Warriors of Chaos is you are going to find that veteran players are going to know exactly where to hit you. I mean, target priority in that list is very, very straightforward. I mean, if he's taking chosen, you just wipe them off the board with magic and you just overpower that unit. They drop like flies, and like, that's, you know, a huge chunk of his army is just gone.
Yep. Well, and I mean, that's the big thing with Chosen is it's the same thing with Bretonians, where it's just like, at the end of the day, your core knights are going to be better because they die the same as your elite knights that cost twice as much. So it's just like, you know, sure, they have all of these different abilities. Their combat output is higher. Their weapons options are different, but they die the same, you know. And I think that's always the problem when you look at dumping lots of points into one of those elite units. You know, I'll always say, you know, caution, like, beware, because, you know, you're never going to run a hand weapon shield Zeench Chosen squad because your fucking basic warriors do it better or do it as good.
As good for cheaper.
For less points. Yep. So, you know, like I said, I think that's why most armies for Warriors of Chaos do fall into that same mold. And, I mean, one thing that I do want to, you know, kind of lament, though, is the fact that I haven't seen a Chaos Chariot ran in God knows how long.
Yeah.
Despite them being some of, if not the best chariots in the game. I mean,
well, they're super tough, and they've got a great save, and, like, they hit really, really hard. But I think that's very, very common in this edition for people to just ignore chariots altogether. I mean, there's very few armies that I go up against now that if they have the option for a chariot, they take, like, they just don't take it. I think the only ones who I see take it on a regular basis is Dark Elves.
See, you know, like I said, even then, I don't. I think the only army I've ever seen with a chariot has been an Empire with a War Altar. That's it. You know, for all of 8th edition. And again, I don't get it, because, I mean, with the changes to chariots, they're not auto-popped on strength 7+. So, I mean, even if they get hit by one of those more accurate cannonballs, you know, you still need to do the D6 wounds and roll greater than in order to pop it. And again, with warriors, why it kind of makes no sense to me is a Chaos Chariot is fucking cheap in an army where everything is expensive. Because, I mean, really, I mean, one unit of warriors could buy me 3 chariots.
Right.
I just don't get it. Like I said, it's just crazy. But no, in terms of the marks that you said, I do think that Khorne and Zeench are absolutely the best. Khorne, if you're going for a super combat-y unit. Zeench, if you're going defensive. I think Nurgle used to be king, but with how little shooting there is now in this edition, I find, from basic missile troops. You know, the
well, main it's just Nurgle very expensive. Is just lessened. It's the most expensive mark, right? If I remember correctly, it's the most expensive mark.
It or Zeench. I mean, they're very comparable, but at the end of the day, yeah.
Because I was Nurgle playing against a buddy of mine, and we had a game against his Chaos, and we played another game with his Beastman, and he kept kind of saying, like, I just don't know what's going on. I was trying to convince him that, you know, like, okay, you have him painted Nurgle, but that doesn't mean you have to take the mark, man. Like, they're painted Nurgle, fine. They worship Nurgle, but, like, it's a really, really expensive mark. Once you remove those 4 or 5 marks out of your army, you know, like, you've made up a huge ton of points that you can put into another character or another unit, or you can just beef out the units that you have, and your army's just going to perform probably just as well 9 times out of 10. You know, there's very, very few situations where a unit of, you know, knights with the mark of Nurgle, who are already a super high weapon skill, having your opponent's weapon skill reduced 1 more isn't really making a difference for you all that much. Like, yeah, you might not be getting as many hits back sometimes, but it's just a lot of points to throw into that, like, every once in a while it pays off category.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And that's why in 7th, when, you know, because the Mark of Nurgle is that dual purpose, -1 to hit with shooting as well as the -1 to weapon skill in combat. In 7th edition, where there was more shooting, you got more turns of shooting. Armies took more shooting units. Like, when all of that was there, Mark of Nurgle was worth its weight in gold, because it literally meant that your small army of very expensive dudes got into combat with more dudes there.
Right.
But now with, you know, with everything hitting combat turn 2, who the fuck cares? So, yeah, definitely stick with Zeench, stick with Khorne, be a minimalist on your characters. Not really much else to say.
I think that we covered it pretty well, so I think we can move on to the main topic of our show here. It's interesting when you run a podcast with 2 people who kind of run the gambit between stupid or, like, high ego or just exceptionally opinionated about one thing or another. And so
D, all of the above.
D, all of the above, I think works exceptionally well. So obviously, as we're kind of rolling into the 30s of our podcast here, it's been quite a while so far. I think that it's time for us to just take a step back and kind of look back at some of the things that we've said over the last months here, and maybe just recant on some comments that we made, or, you know, talk about how our minds have changed in that period of time, because, hey, we're allowed to change our minds, obviously, like any good politician. The tides change. Things happen.
Listen, what I say on the campaign trail and what I do once elected are completely different. We
exactly.
all knew this.
You're like the Newt Gingrich of the current political run. Like, you're gonna. Hey, I'm not gonna get into that joke. Anyways, Nathan, I think the one that you wanted to talk about was actually a great one to start this out. So why don't you get into that?
Yeah, you know, I have a couple off the top of my head, but I think the biggest one has been my staunch defense of 40K. And I really think a few things have happened, because, I mean, we started this podcast about seven-ish months ago, I think, seven, eight, fuck, I don't know. Hey, it's just one of those things.
It was somewhere around there.
Yeah, as I said, it's one of those things we do every Saturday. Who knew? But no, like I said, it's, you know, we started a long time ago, and I think back then, the landscape was a little bit different, but I used to be a very staunch defender of 40K to you. Cause I mean, for you, the game had just kind of fallen into Lord of the Rings territory, where it's just like, if I have stuff and someone else wants to play, it's okay.
Well, you know, it was, like I said, it was always the game where I was just like, can we just play fantasy?
Yeah. You know, but like I said, I think back then things were different. The armies that were out were a little bit different, and the metagame hadn't quite cemented what it is now. But over the last 6 months, I really think that 40K, when you look at the army releases, because, I mean, what was our episode 2, you know, Dark Eldar release?
Right.
Kind of thing. So it's just like, you know, Dark Eldar were a great book, but then Grey Knights came out, and I really just think that Games Workshop ruined 40K. So for me, I want to say that really the game is kind of dead to me right now. Like, I'm really just waiting for 6th edition. I have no urges to play at all. And I think it's a combination of, you know, the feelings I have towards my Tyranids, their effectiveness in tournaments due to the gaping design flaws, and the fact that every last game of 40K you play is going to be up against the same type of army, which is all mech. So, and Imperium, whether that be Marines or Guard. So it's just playing 40K the last couple months has just felt like a, you know, it's felt like a chore. Like, there's been absolutely no joy or fun to it whatsoever. So for me, yeah, I'm definitely going to recant that whole 40K love thing. And, you know, I'm just going to bide my time,
You just talked about how brilliant it was. Oh, it's just so brilliant. Like, everything is brilliant.
But I mean, here's the thing. the game's just, like, when you look at the core rules of 5th edition, I stand by it. It is brilliant, and it is the best set of core rules that 40K has ever had for as long as I've played, which has been since 3rd edition. So including 3rd and 4th, 5th
right.
edition is easily the best set of rules.
But then we talk about the codices.
And that is really where the game just fucking falls apart, because when you look at it, really the only 5th edition Codex release that hasn't been like mind-fuckingly stupid was Vanilla Marines, number one out of the gates, and everything after that has just sucked, you know? It's ruined the games. The points balances have been all wrong. Like, why is it that every single Imperium army gets a discount on their vehicles, and then Dark Eldar, who still have the most easily destroyed vehicle in the game, goes up in cost, you know? Yeah. So it's just like, it's one of those things where you just look at it and it's just like the changes to the codexes, when combined with the changes to the core rules, have just basically led the entire game to fall into this one path. I mean, when I played my Tyranids in a tournament, I knew that 100% of my games would be against mech armies, and it didn't matter whether you were Space Wolves or Blood Angels or Imperial Guard. What I, as a Tyranid player, had to do was exactly the same. So every single game I played was the same. And at first, you know, you kind of think, oh, this is challenging, and I'm going to play this, and maybe I'll try something else. But then you just fall into that fucking rut of, this works, so I'm going to keep doing it. So every game I play, I'm using the same strategies.
Yes.
I don't like to tailor my lists. I like to kind of...
Well, and the scenarios don't give you anything either.
No, and that's the other thing is the scenarios are boring as fuck. You know, like really, that's what it is when they first came out. You know, when you compared them to fourth edition, which was, you know, basically just cleanse.
Right. Cleanse, you know, whether it was table quarters or long edges, like that was about it.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. And victory points, right? So it was just like I either deployed in a cleanse or I deployed long table edges and it was victory points. So then when you first started playing games of 5th edition, it was fresh, it was exciting. But then, you know, again, you play it for a couple of years and those scenarios get old. And even then, most tournament organizers, it's really hard to come up with brilliant scenarios for 40K, which is why when you even get Adepticon, what is it? Well, it's rulebook scenarios with modified kill points and victory points added in. Whoopty shit. You know, I'm still playing the exact same things. Oh, every now and then we changed up your deployment zone. Whoa, everyone sit down. Shit's getting crazy. You know,
so what you were saying is that I was right.
As much as it does pain me to say so and admit, yes. But yes. Even then, I don't know.
You can't give me more than a second worth of joy.
No, not at all. You know, really what I think it is, you know, 8th edition is just so good. And so far, I would say that 8th edition army books are 2 for 2. You know, they haven't been overwhelmingly powerful. They're not showing any signs of codex.
Well, and there's been a plan. There's been a very clear plan of, like, how they want to change the game, how they want to make it fit with the 8th edition rules, you know, what they want to do with this stuff. And where we talk about things like psychic powers and monstrous creatures and like scenarios and all this kind of stuff together, it's very clear that when they're putting these books out for Warhammer 40,000, that they're not really thinking about those types of things. Like they're just building a standalone book that the rule book is a supplement to that codex. Like it doesn't feel like they're trying to build a really cohesive game. And it's tough for me because I do want to get really excited about Warhammer 40,000. Like, you know, I hear things about the Necrons or I hear things about the Tau and I hear people talking about, oh, they're going to change this for the next army that comes out. Like, I get very excited about that. I think it's actually going to be very, very cool. But then I start thinking about like, well, I'm going to get into that army. I'm going to start painting it. And then I'm going to play like a game or two and I'm just going to lose all love for it again because I realize that nothing's changed. You know, like it's just more of the, if I'm lucky enough to get a book that's, you know, over the top and it's at, you know, it takes advantage of 5th edition more than other rule books, then I might be, you know, good or the winningest general or whatever the hell people want to be these days. It's just like I lose that love for it. As soon as, like, I love the background. I love the theme. I mean, you and I go on and on about Gaunt's Ghost and Eisenhorn and all those books. I mean, like, it's second to none, the story and the theme as part of Warhammer 40,000, right? But it just falls apart, right? Like, it absolutely falls apart as soon as you start actually looking at playing the game, you know?
Yep.
And well, I think that's the biggest point of frustration for me because, like I said, I want to get excited for it.
Yeah, you know, and that's the other thing is, I mean, even when you look at it, if you look at 5th edition as it came out, I mean, when Tyranids were released, nobody jumped off the Marine and Imperial Guard bandwagon. You know, they didn't. They literally just kept playing Marines and Guards, and Tyranids were just sort of a footnote, where Tyranid players were just like, huzzah, new rules, new models, and we changed our lists. And no one really picked up the army.
Woo, then, Pirate Wars!
Fucking Pirate Wars. But I mean, you know, like that's the thing, is like, no one really picked that up. And then, you know, Games Workshop's insistence of alternating Marine armies. So, I mean, really, 5th edition came out, and what did you have? You had Marines, Guard, Marines, you know.
Yeah.
And then you had Tyranids, which were a footnote that no one really picked up on, then Marines again. And Dark Eldar were the first army that, you know, really took off and sold a ton of. Because, I mean, really, look at it. They've had 3 waves of models, and the Tyranids haven't had 2 yet.
Right.
You know, like, you know, so I mean, it's very clear that the Dark Eldar are selling because Games Workshop just keeps putting out more Dark Eldar release models. But even then, when you go to a tournament, the makeup hasn't changed. You still go to a tournament and it is still 90% Space Marines Imperial Guards, 10% other. Yes, Dark Eldar are probably the most popular of the other choices. But
at the moment.
At the moment, you're absolutely right. You know, and I think that's my problem is then, you know, Grey Knights came out and for those that follow the tournament circuit, I know Blood of Kittens always has really good reviews because they list tabs and things like that. When you look at the army breakdown, Dark Eldar came out in November. They have, in my opinion, the best looking model range in all of Warhammer 40,000.
Yeah.
Grey Knights had been out for about 2 weeks, and there were three times the number of Grey Knight players as Dark Eldar players at the last tournament that they ran. And so that's why it's just like, it's infuriating to go to a tournament and it's impossible to get excited about the game, because I know, you know, like, I'm excited about Necron rumors. You know, I always thought the army was kind of bland, but these rumors really feel like they're adding a lot of flavor. But I know that if I were to pick it up and I were to paint it, I would go to a tournament and that it would be no different. I would still be the token Xenos player that gets paired up against four Marine armies or four Imperium, if we're going to count Guard as well. And so it's just like, how does anything change? You know, and I think that's my big frustration with 5th edition, because, I mean, previous editions of 40K were never this Marine Imperium centric. And I really feel that for me anyway, it's ruining the game. Now, obviously, 90% of the player base is still eating this shit up, so it's not ruining it for them. But for me, just can't wait for 6th edition, and hopefully GW will stop releasing Marine books.
Well, I don't think that will ever happen, but we can always dream. Okay. Well,
hopefully they'll stop releasing fetish Marine books.
Fetish Marine books. Let's hope for no fetish Marine books. Oh, what a glorious day that would be, with no vajazzled cod pieces on the table. So
blood vajazzled.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, it was Matt Ward, so it's blood vajazzling. I could make that joke 10 times worse, but I'm gonna stay classy right now. Okay, so
as classy as I get.
I'm gonna go on to something here. You and I had a slightly spirited conversation back in the early days of the podcast, where we were talking about soft scores, and you were apparently, according to your wife, too drunk to defend yourself appropriately. And you know, like, it was just one of those conversations where I was just like, soft scores are bad, rah. And obviously, like, if you pay attention to the Facebook page, or you pay attention to some of the other kind of side conversations that we've had on the show here since then, obviously, you know, like, I go back on that and a lot of the stuff that I'd gone off on at that moment, and I've kind of changed my mind on it, where we talked about things like composition and painting and, you know, sportsmanship and all this kind of stuff. And for me, it wasn't really composition. It was always sportsmanship was the one that I felt like that just needed to be out the window. I mean, I do get the reasoning for it. I think that there are good ways to do sportsmanship and there are bad ways to do it. I mean, like, it just, for me, sportsmanship is always the one that just isn't, it's never really accurate, but, I do understand the reasoning behind it. So, like, I will go back on that a little bit, and say that, you know, if a tournament organizer is putting sportsmanship into the game, sportsmanship is something that is, I don't know, like, it's just something that it cannot be left in the hands of your opponent, you know? Because sportsmanship is so easily abused, and it's so easily, you know, like, people grabbing onto those trends where it's just like, oh, you played this army and you took two hell cannons, zero sportsmanship. Well, no, that's composition, and that's not your decision to make. Like, you need to talk about the game, or, you know, composition or sportsmanship, the rules behind it need to be laid out a lot clearer, you know, where actually the only thing that you're judging on sportsmanship is deductions. Like, hey, everybody gets a 3 to start, and you only deduct something if something was bad, you know, where everyone's kind of on that even playing field. But we all know people don't read their fucking player packs, and we all know that people don't judge sportsmanship according to how good the game was or how good a sport people were. And everyone gets all antsy about it when they think, like, he's just being a good sport because he wants the sportsmanship score. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. That's still him making a good game and swallowing his
mission
pride.
Mission fucking accomplished.
Mission accomplished. Like, so, like, if that's all that it accomplishes, then I think it accomplishes enough. But, you know, like I said, I still think that's broken. I still think it's overly abused. I think, you know, sportsmanship really, really does need to be done in a way where it's made very, very clear to both you and your opponent, like, how it's being scored and, like, what your scores are being given, you know? Or, like, if you give your opponent a 2, you only get a 2. Like, it's a mirrored sportsmanship score, you know? Like, I don't know. Like, it is one of those things that I do kind of want to recant on, because I do go back now on the soft scores for composition and sportsmanship, and I do understand the need for them a little bit better, even just through all of the conversations that we've had.
Yeah. Well,
But yeah,
you know what's very interesting about sportsmanship is I know people always latch onto the whole, like, well, I won the game, so he gave me a zero. But I mean, you know, as a tournament organizer and as someone that inputted all of the tabs for you know, the last event, I can honestly say that shit doesn't happen. What typically happens with sportsmanship, which always, you know, kind of rankles, you know, us as our organizing committee, because we're always just like, what? Why do we have this score? Is almost everyone gets max points now. It's just like, if the scale is out of five, every single person gets a four or a five. So, you know, when a three crops up, you're just like, man, that was a bad game. Like, these people did not have fun at all. Like, so, I mean, like, that's the other thing that I always find with sportsmanship that I find that's very difficult in trying to make it a meaningful score is, how do you try to come up with a system that is going to result in an actual spread? Because in theory, right, if I have a scale from 1 to 5, my standard deviation, and yes, I'm a math geek, shut the fuck up, should be the majority of scores are going to fall into that 2 to 4 range, with the outliers being the 1s and the 5s, not
right,
absolutely fucking everybody is a 4 or a 5. Like,
well, it just... and that brings up another interesting point where, like, when you run a tournament where you have a best sportsmanship slot and you're giving away a trophy for best sportsmanship, I mean, I've put in tabs and I've filled those out too for other tournaments that I've, you know, been involved with or been helping people out with. And it's like, you get 12 guys with the exact same sportsmanship score. It's like, how the hell are you supposed to choose who the best sport is, you know? And usually they just go with the guy with the lowest generalship score. But it's like, that still is just, it's so pointless. Yeah. Like, why even, you know, have that as part of the game?
Thankfully, we've never run into that, because we've never had people with tied votes for sportsmanship. So, I mean, that's always sort of helped us out. Because, I mean, even with our last event, you know, we run faction events, but I mean, with the last one, the guy that won best overall for his faction basically won it on the back of sportsmanship, because, you know, the guy he was up against, you know, they're very neck and neck. The guy he was up against was the worst sport on that side, and he was the best. You know, he basically won the best sportsmanship award because he got 12 bonus points on sportsmanship, which bumped him 1 point ahead of the other guy. So it's just like, that's right, the thing where it's just like, thankfully with votes, we've never had it be close or have it be a tie, because typically, even if everyone's getting a 5, not everyone's getting a vote. So, I mean, really, it always just comes down to that voting aspect to determine best sport. But yeah, so, I mean, like, that's the thing. And I think that's also why we've never run the same sportsmanship system in back-to-back events. Because, like I said, it's just one of those things where we're trying to come up with a way where we will get the standard deviation that makes sense. Because there's no way that when you go to a tournament, every last fucking game is awesome. It's like I'm gaming on rainbows. It's fantastic. You know, no. You never have.
I feel like Thor carrying Mjolnir on the rainbow road. No, I mean, I, like I said, you know, like I get into that and I enjoy that part of the game. And like, I feel like I'm a good sport, but I get very, we've said this before, like I get very passionate during my games. Like I'm just like, you know, and. Like, anybody who listens to us bitch and complain after the games are done know that it's just like, oh, we get into it. But, like, it's always a fun game. Like, we always enjoy the company, whether it's bad dice or it's, you know, bad tactics or things just don't go your way, or you utterly roll the player across from you and you're like, that wasn't the greatest, but, you know, it was still fun to play you. I do understand, like, that part of the game. But let's move on here. You had one more, Nathan.
Yeah, and this is one I haven't talked to you about, so this might actually come as a surprise.
Hit it.
Lore of Heavens is the shit.
Wow, and that wasn't too long ago.
No, it wasn't. You know, it's you know, I do want to put a caveat on that, though. You really need Lore Master to make it work.
Because we said that back during that podcast, but we were just like, the only way to play this lore is with Lore Master.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, I think at the end of the day, Lore of Heavens is still the worst lore you could ever choose when it comes down to, you know, random dice rolls, because that lore can fuck you harder than any other lore there is. So it's just like when you have a choice of lores and you know you're going to be rolling two dice on it, never take heavens, because it's too unreliable. With that being said, God, does Lore of Heavens just have some really, really nice, neat tricks? Like the last time I played it, I only got two spells off because I just run my wizard solo now. I don't bother trying to bunker him and slow my flamers down, because I find that to be counterintuitive. So I run him, you know, around by himself. I got two spells off, and I can honestly say that Lore of Heavens was single-handedly responsible for me tabling him by the bottom of turn three. Because, kind of a dick move, but I threw Comet of Cassandora down turn one, and then hilariously it went four more turns before of adding turns until it went off. But because it hadn't gone off, he kind of ran past it, and then I used Wind Blast to push him right back on the token.
Dirty.
See? Dick move. No, but I mean, when I was thinking about it, Lore of Heavens has all the tools you really need if you have Lore Master. Because, I mean, just from Watchtower alone, I can drop a Comet on the Watchtower and rape the unit inside. I can throw Uranon's Thunderbolt or Chain Lightning. And again, I'm going to do some decent damage because these are all Strength 6 magic missiles. Then you combine that with the augments and the hexes. And like I said, it all just kind of comes together. And at least for my demons, it really just kind of fills every single hole. Because unlike, say, Life, where, you know, everyone knows the two spells they need to dispel. You know, it's just like everyone knows you dispel Throne in your turn and you never let them get Flesh to Stone or Regrowth off. Period. You know, if he gets Dwellers off, if you're, depending on the army you're playing, that could either hurt you really bad or not so much because it is a strength test. So, I mean, it's one of those spells.
Depends on your army.
Exactly. Depends on your army and whether you need to really just block it off entirely or not. But really, Life is very unreliable. I tried beasts with my demons, but I find the problem with beasts is all of the augments are only on characters, and demon characters are already fucking fantastic. So why would I make my already very powerful guys even more powerful? Like, it runs counterintuitive. And like I said, I was just kind of going through the block, and it actually came down to I was going to try metal for a game. But thought I was going to be playing a Bretonian player, and I was just like, it just felt like list tailoring. So I was looking at all the other lores, and it was just like, I'm going to give Heavens a whirl. And yeah, like I said, it really, really works. Cause I mean, if you have Lore Master, you have the ability to cast every spell from that lore. It's astounding. It really is.
Well, you know, and I do think that, you know, when we talked about the lore, you know, one of the problematic things about it was like there's not one thing that it really excels at. You know, like it's got a lot of damage stuff. It's got some high level damage stuff, but it's usually only D6, or you don't have a really like the level 6 spell for Lore of Heavens. Like, it doesn't have a really, really good chance of like popping between units. And Comet of Cassandora can be a little bit tricky and undependable at times. Wind Blast is only good in those odd situations here. You know, like, that was a lot of kind of what we ran into. So, I mean, like, yeah, it does have a little bit of everything when it comes to cool stuff. And the signature spell is fun. Being able to reduce somebody's leadership is always great. You know, so, I mean, like, sometimes it can make the difference between an army breaking or an army, you know, obviously, or an army standing and fighting. But I mean, like, even when we did the podcast, I did say, like, it's not terrible. Like, it's not a waste of time. But, like, if you're going to play it, you do have to kind of understand that you're not going to have one thing that you do amazingly. Yeah. Whereas, like, Lore of Life is really defensive, and you're regening guys, and you've got Toughness 8, and you've got, Shield of Thorns and all these other cool things, and you're immune to miscast, so you're not going to be Lore of Light, where, you know, it's very offensive and you're sitting there pumping all of these augments on top of each other, making it so that your army is like untouchable and they're beating the shit out of other people, you know, but it does a little bit of everything.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, like, that's the thing, is just like, I think I ran Lore of Life for about five or six games, And I can honestly say that Flesh to Stone was always dispelled. I never got it off ever, because everyone knows you don't want to, you know, even without Throne of Vines, plus two toughness, it is game changing. So, I mean, everyone knows kill that spell. Additionally, regrowth, I would maybe only get off once per turn, and that was always when, you know, if it was a bad wins roll where I rolled six or less dice, I just picked up every last one of them, threw them all, I might be able to muscle through on a level two, and get regrowth off. And then even then, it's still that dice roll. I remember once I needed it. I desperately needed it. I rolled a one, so I threw every last power dice of the phase to get two plague bearers back. Whoopty shit.
Right.
You know, so I mean, I think that's the thing with life is with life, you need to have a shit ton of dice to be able to muscle through the important spells, and you need a level four. Otherwise, the lore is, and you really need lore master on life. You need it more than you need it on heavens. Or that lore is gonna come and bite you in the ass.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Not gonna really do what you need it to do. So I mean, like, that's the thing. It's just like, if you have to roll randomly for spells, I would stick to something reliable like shadow, like light, like metal, you know, where it's just like, you know, pick a lore where
no I matter. I still don't feel you on shadow, but yeah.
Yeah.
See, and I think that the lores of magic are really interesting in that way, because, I mean, we talked about it on the podcast, and, like, even since that podcast, you know, where I was just like, Lore of Light's the greatest thing you could ever take, yada, 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 yada. And it's just like, I've now had a couple games where when I'm sitting there playing Lore of Light, it's very frustrating because I'm so dependent on a good Winds of Magic roll to really make that lore pop that it becomes very frustrating. Where now I've started playing with Lore of Metal in almost every single game, because when I play Lore of Metal and I get like a low Winds roll, I'll take all my dice and just cast Glittering Robes on the bubble and just be happy for that entire turn that, like, my entire army has, like, a 3-plus or a 2-plus save, you know? So, I mean, like, that has one bubble spell that is enormous. Whereas with Light, I'm so dependent on getting a big magic roll, you know, so that I can get 2 to 3 bubbles off to make that really, really work, that as soon as I roll, like, a 1 and a 3 for my Winds of Magic, it's like, all right, well, now I'm in trouble. You know, I have to pick one unit and make them really good, which a lot of times it's just not enough to keep my army going, considering my army only has one character. I think that you could really stick with Lore of Light if you were playing a Lizardman army or another army that had Lore Master that had a lot of characters on the table. So you wouldn't have to necessarily pick and choose the one that you figure is going to do the most damage, and everything else gets neglected on a low Winds of Magic roll. You know, it's kind of nice to be able to look at that Lore of Magic and say, like, well, that unit has a character or two in it. You know, this unit's kind of on its own. I'm going to hit this unit with it, or I want my characters to do this much more because they're in challenges. Mm-hmm. You know, I just think there's a lot of reasons that, like, when you're talking about an army with one character, it's just not enough. But Lore of Metal, on the other hand, when you've got just one character, like, that does everything you need. You know, it makes your temple card that much more survivable. It makes everything that much more survivable.
Yep.
You know, they're already fighting enough, and if you can get the frickin' enchanted blades on a unit, even better. So, yeah, I think Lore of Magic is the one that, like, I don't know, I'd say for the next year we're going to be flip-flopping on.
Hey, you know what? You're totally right, and that was one thing that we even said in our you know, lore masturbation episode. Hey, listen, you were the one that said you had that show fucking pride. You were just like, I wanted to say that for weeks.
Locked and loaded for weeks. Anyways.
But no, I mean, that was one of the things we said, where depending on the army that you're playing, and really just depending on your magic situation, is what lore is going to do it for you. And that's why for me, I really think that, you know, with my Demons of Chaos, where I only have one level 2 wizard with Lore Master, I don't think I will ever change from Heavens with them, simply because, again, like I said, if it's Watchtower, and I don't take it because, hey, I intentionally don't have any legal units to take it. All I have to do is just keep dropping comets on it turn after turn after turn and stand next to it, and I win. Because eventually those comets are going to wipe it out, and then I can zip a movement 10 something next to it and just be like, I win.
Yeah, no. And that we, you know, comets great for Watchtower. We even said it on the Lore Master podcast. But, okay, so let's get moving here. I don't have a stupidity check for this week because I'm on vacation, so you guys can just deal with the fact that I don't have one. Instead, I'm going to read a piece of email that we got Actually, it was like 2 hours ago we got it, which is hilarious. So anyways, this is from Hot Panda, star, 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 which...
Hello, Hot Panda. Are you single?
He says, I started listening to your podcast several weeks ago. The show is top-notch. Well, thank you. Well, you know,
we do love flattery.
Flattery will get you everywhere.
The show is top. The crickets make it top-notch.
It is. It is. But yeah, the show is top-notch. But then again, that might just be the Scotch talk. Oh, yeah, it might. It probably is, honestly. I feel like the show is a lot more entertaining when I'm drinking Scotch, clearly. He says, anyhow, I have two questions for the two of you. He says, Nathan, you had talked about repainting armies and starting new ones. I'm in this boat as well and wanted to repaint my Chaos Space Marine army that has some heavy green stuff conversions on the majority of my models. Normally, I would just throw my models into simply green, but I don't want it breaking down the green stuff. Any tips on how I can strip these models without having to redo green stuff? We kind of talked about this a little bit on the Facebook page, where a lot of people were given these various ideas and things that you could do to get into it. So I would say definitely check that out. But honestly, like, I've never had to strip a model that's had green stuff on it. But what I do know is that typically green stuff dries really hard. Like, it's harder than plastic. So anything that you're throwing it into, I would say 9 times out of 10, that's going to be safe for plastic models will be safe for your green stuff as well. Like, it's safe for your super glue. It's safe for everything. And, like, green stuff dries hard. So
no,
I would
yeah, yeah, you're too absolutely much about. Right. Because that's the other thing is the Simply Green bath is basically just working on the chemistry of it, of its melting the plastic that's in the paint, which is a softer plastic than the model itself. So, you know, if the Simply Green bath will not melt the plastic model, which is softer than the green stuff, then yeah, you know, I agree with Lang. Like, that shit dries hard. I do not believe that it will do any harm to the green stuff whatsoever.
Yep. Well, and
I personally have never stripped a model with green stuff. So if you're worried, take one guy. The
yep.
least That's amount of green say. Stuff on it and give him a test. Cause like I said, I honestly don't know. I've never done it.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with just a test model, man. I mean, you're at that point where one model is going to be fine. It's not going to make or break your army. And trust me, if you've been playing 40K for a while, especially fucking Chaos Space Marines, you have some extra models that you don't use. Okay. Grab one of those guys. Toss them into the green stuff. Let them sit extra long, you know, just in case to see, you know, if I let them sit for too long, is it going to cause problems? And, you know, just be freaking Bill Nye the Science Guy for like a few hours and don't write into podcasts who don't know what they're talking about. Anyways. question.
Yeah, are we a painting podcast? Seriously.
I couldn't tell you. Number two, during the 5 years that he was in E-Town playing 40K, he heard about 50% of the tournaments running locally in the area, yet you two seem to be 100% connected into the tournament scene. And I would like to know how you do it. He says, it's too late for me to get tapped into E-Town scene as I am moving away to V-Town. Any tips would be great. Cheers. First off, we are not 100% tapped into the tournament scene. I want to make that perfectly clear.
Wizards and magic. That is how.
Pretty much, right? A wizard did it. Well, in scene two, she was flying a winged Appalachia, and then a wizard did it. That's pretty much it. No. I mean, it's just since we started doing the podcast, we have actually been more and more tapped in. And I think that it's really important to realize that that's all it takes. If you want to get tapped into the local gaming scene in that area, like there's the Edmonton Warhammer. There you go. I broke the code. There's the Edmonton.
God damn
I know
it, you and Danny. Seriously.
Dude, you've broken it like 4 or 5 times. You go fuck yourself.
I think I was the first person.
You
to
did
break
it like
actually.
Right
like,
off the
like
bat.
Three
your
or
wife,
four,
your
like,
wife was throwing right hands at you for breaking the
right.
code.
That's
whatever.
True.
We're gonna get this joke out. But anyways, like I was saying, there's very likely a Facebook page for that local gaming group. Obviously, there's gaming clubs. Obviously, there's tournaments. There's forums. There's all sorts of different things. And I think the really, really big thing that you have to do is literally just get into those things and start talking to people. It's a social game, a community game.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, for me, I mean, it definitely helps that I think the three biggest in our region, I run one. a former coworker runs another, and then two former coworkers runs the third. So, I mean, for me, it's always like, hey, you know, easy peasy. But, I mean, basically what Lang said is correct. Get hooked up online with the local group, because at the end of the day, the really big tournaments are the ones that kind of everyone knows about, and you're not going, you know, these are the ones you're not missing. Where I find I get knowledge of,
excuse me. You okay there, sweetie?
Hey, this is what happens when my alcohol runs out, as I start to get parched near.
I know, I'm out of scotch too.
God damn it. So dry. Well, that is jaded gamer cat. No. No, but I mean, really, what I find it is when you have a large enough sort of local gaming group, or at least when you're plugged into a large enough local gaming group, someone there will find out from someone that there is a tournament happening somewhere. And then they just kind of tell everyone, and they're just like, hey, are you going to go to this? Or are you going to, you know, and basically that's how I find out. Because there was actually a tournament in Dead Rear today. That honestly, it would have completely missed me if not one of those people that I happen to know that's sort of, again, very plugged into the community, very big. He told me, and he was just like, hey, are you going to that tournament? And I was, you know, too busy painting demons, so I said no. But that's what it is I find if you are in a large enough gaming group that is local and you're plugged into them online on their forums, on their Facebook page, whatever the fuck they use, then you will hear about everything because someone in that gaming group will have the connection. They'll know someone that's doing something. They'll hear it. They'll spread the news. And that way you're able to kind of see what it is and pick and choose. Because, I mean, hell, as much as I love tournaments, as much as I'd like to claim that I go to everything, there's no way. Like, there's so many even just sort of little quasi-local tournaments. Because, I mean, like I said, if I was willing to drive an hour today, I could have gotten three games in.
Yeah. Prizes. Well, and I think one of the big things is if you do go out to tournaments and you're talking to your opponents and you're getting involved in the scene and you're actually, you know, trying to interact with people, tournaments are the places where I usually find out about where the next tournament is being held. You know, it's like Fight Club, you know, or it's like the Fast and the Furious racing scene where they're just like, yo, dude, next week over at the Light Tower, you know, whatever. You know, hey, that'd be awesome to have a tournament in a Light Tower, but I digress. That's
truth.
But that's really what it comes down to is like usually if you're out at a tournament, people are already asking you if you're going to be at the next tournament. And then you can get usually all of the information that you need for that. If you do get plugged into the Facebook groups or if they have a forum or if there's some sort of local online group, talk to people, get interactive. Like, don't just go repost, like actually get into it with people and challenge people, man. That's one of the best ways that I find that I get involved with my gaming groups is I challenge people. Like if I'm talking to somebody, I've seen them around, I've never played them, or, you know, like we never got matched up at a tournament, or I don't go to Vets Night. I'm always just like, dude, come over to my house. We're going to play in my basement. I'm going to kick the shit out of your army. That's how I get to know people, okay? If only my job were like that. It's not the case, though. But anyways.
No, and I think I just want to add one more thing. If you have no idea where to start looking, go onto the GW webpage because at least they'll list the circuit events. And if you're in a big enough town/area, there'll at least be a circuit event that you know is going to bring in, you know, 50 plus people. So you can always start there and try to figure out, you know, who the local gaming groups are and then get plugged in that way. Because, I mean, I do know some that have terrible, terrible online presences. And, you know, the best Googling will not bring them up. So, like I said, even if you're just like, hey, thanks, ass. I already tried. I don't know anything. Check out the GW website. Figure out what the next big circuit event is in your community, attend it, and then just start trying to, you know, start talking to people, start making friends, figure out where the gaming club is, figure out
and when failing, they play. And failing all that, run your own tournaments.
Yes.
Hey. You will get plugged into the tournament scene as fast as anything else if you just decide that you want to try to run your own tournament. And, you know, like, it's not hard to do it, It's a little bit harder to do it right if you're going to really put the time and effort into it, but I mean, you can definitely put tournaments together, and that's going to get you a lot of ins into that whole tournament scene, which is pretty awesome. But as you heard, Nathan and I are both out of drink, and it is hot outside in Arizona, and I think even the crickets have gone to sleep. No, they're still sons of bitches. But anyways. I think we're going to leave it at that. And yeah, we'll go from there. So that is Jaded Gamercast for this week. My name is Lang.
I'm Nathan.
Have a good one.
Cheers.